Welcome to MicroCollege. This week on the podcast, our guest is Eric Schwartz, who is the co-founder and CEO of the College for Social Innovation in Boston. MicroCollege podcast is a product of Thoreau College, a MicroCollege located in rural southwestern Wisconsin. My name is Jacob Hunt. I'm the founder and director. We are currently accepting applications for our Summer Shakespeare Festival, as well as for our fall and spring Metamorphosis Gap Semester programs. So check us out on the web and send in an application. Today, as I mentioned, our guest is Eric Schwartz from the College of Social Innovation, which seeks to educate and inspire the next generation of problem solvers for humanity's tough challenges. CFSI seeks to build a bigger, better prepared, and more diverse talent pipeline for the social impact sector through its flagship Semester in the City experiential learning program in Boston and the new National Semester for Impact program. Eric is also co-founder and former CEO of Citizen Schools, an apprenticeship-based model for out-of-school time learning, which has had a positive impact on the after-school and extended learning time fields across the U.S. Prior to starting Citizen Schools in 1995, Eric served as vice president of City Year, the National Service Program, and as a journalist at the Oakland Tribune and the Patriot Ledger in Quincy, Massachusetts, where he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He serves on a number of boards and is also the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Opportunity Equation, with the co-editor of The Case for the 21st Century Learning, and the author of numerous articles and book chapters, including Calling All Citizens in the New York Times bestselling Waiting for Superman. Eric graduated from the University of Vermont in 1983 and from the Harvard Graduate School of Education in 97. He lives in Brookline, Mass, with his wife and two children. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Thank you, Jacob, for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm really excited to learn about the College for Social Innovation and also to hear your story. So here on the MicroCollege podcast, we always start with people's biographies, and particularly the period of life of that we are working with in our organizations. So I'd like to ask you to reflect and to reminisce of where you were, 18 to 21 years old. What were the big influences on your life? Where were you doing? And what has from that period has followed you ever since?
Awesome. Yeah, that was a period of a lot of change and growth for me. Get into that, and definitely in retrospect was really the inspiration for College for Social Innovation. So at 18, I was still in high school, my third high school. I graduated barely the spring of that year, and I was, unhappy. I was, I guess, an okay student, but not really motivated, and self-medicating with too much alcohol and too many drugs, and kind of aimless. I went to college because I had some great friends who went to UVM, and it seemed like a really fun place. I had a fun freshman year, but wasn't learning a lot. My dad approached me about halfway through, a little past the halfway point in freshman year, and said, "Eric, I know these people who are U.S. senators." He had done some work in Washington, running for re-election in the campaign of 1980. And there's people in Iowa and Idaho and South Dakota and Colorado who you could maybe intern for this summer. I picked the Coloradan, a man named Gary Hart, because I had a girlfriend going to Colorado College. That seemed like the logical choice,
Of course.
and I knew nothing about him. But went there for what was originally going to be like an 8 or 10 week summer internship, help on the campaign, hold some signs, do some writing, et cetera, and ended up changing my life. I pretty quickly moved from, mowing the lawn, counting nickels and dimes that were collected at a political convention, to writing letters to the editor, writing a position paper, helping to organize fundraisers with Jimmy Buffett and Linda Ronstadt and other kind of rock stars of the era, and came to the conclusion I no way I could leave in August, as had been the plan. Called up UVM, said, "I'll be back in February for the second semester. I'm staying till election day." And the campaign put me in charge of organizing college students, and I worked my tail off through election day, I think November 4th or 5th that year. He won barely in what was then kind of a red to purple state amidst the Reagan landslide. He got anointed as like a future presidential candidate, and he ran twice, almost successful one of those times. And I got a sense of purpose. I, in retrospect, I think learned more from that summer and fall, that extended internship, than I did, I think, in all 32 of my courses put together. I built a network for life. I got another internship with him in his Washington, D.C. office 2 summers later. And then my first job after graduating from college was helping to, play a leadership role on his first presidential campaign. It was transformative. And it was transformative because of a set of relationships, a set of mentors. I discovered some talents that I had around organizing that I didn't necessarily know I had. I think I built some new skills. And I came back to UVM just a different person. Like, it was 6 months later, but I was just a different person. I threw myself into my classes in a different way. I signed up to work on the college newspaper because I realized that every staff meeting on the campaign ended with, like, what are the reporters for the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post going to write? I said, wow, these people seem to have a lot of influence. And so I did college journalism and then worked as a journalist after college. But that experience stuck with me for the rest of my life. I went on to be a better student, editor of the college newspaper. I guess I really wasn't conscious of this at the time, but as I look back on it, that was an experience. It was very much a 1% experience. My dad, not everyone has a dad who knows 6 U.S. senators who can say, oh, you could work for this one or work for that one. And not a lot of people have parents who can fully support them financially to allow them to have this kind of incredible gap semester that, that did change my life. And what we're trying to do with College for Social Innovation is make that kind of experience, not necessarily in politics, probably not in politics, but in social action and social change, make it common, not rare. Make it accessible to a much broader portion of the population.
So that, did you, and so that phrase, a gap year, a gap semester, right? A gap program. I'm sure you didn't use that word to describe what you were doing there, right?
Right. No, I was just like doing I think I might have occasionally said it was an internship or a job, or initially it was like a summer job. Yeah, there's nothing gap about it. But I've come to appreciate this big movement for like gap years, but also be a little worried about it as someone who's spent most of my adult life trying to lessen the opportunity divide so that we can lessen like the achievement gap that's more of a chasm than a gap. I just worry that so much of what we put together as a society continues to further advantage the already advantaged. And people like me get access to these really cool gap year or gap semester experiences. But until we move it from being extracurricular, where richer people access it, to being curricular, where a broader population who are Pell eligible or maybe low income can access it, we're gonna kind of worsen, not improve the opportunity gap.
Yeah, that's something that I wish some more people understood, or would like to help more people understand, is how valuable those unstructured, those outside of the classroom experiences are, and how, people in positions of privilege, they've known that forever, right? And they provide those for their kids, for themselves and for their families. But it isn't, when you think about like raising up people in poverty and stuff like that, they're not creating,
Yeah.
retreats or gap programs and things like that. It's more, it's more tests and more like it's nose to the grindstone kind of stuff.
That's
That's
exactly
that's
it.
how privileged people do it themselves.
I mean, so the book you referenced in the introduction, the book I wrote 8 or 10 years ago called The Opportunity Equation. And in that, I tell the story of my own kids growing up in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is a wealthy but also very diverse economically and otherwise community right on the outskirts of Boston. In our particular kindergarten through 8th grade school, had three public housing developments feeding into it, plus some of, you know, people living in multi-million dollar homes. And it was so interesting, you know, in second grade, third grade, fourth grade, my kids' best friends, at least half of them lived in those public housing developments. Everyone seemed pretty equal in school. They had the same teachers. And by middle school, you started to see a bigger divide socially and academically. And it, you know, some of it may have been implicit racism by the teachers, but I think the bigger share of the growing divide was just night and day out of school learning experiences, that the wealthier families were paying for extra tutoring, extra coaching, sports camps, band camp, computer camp, you know, acting camp, all, you know, all kinds of cool things that help, you know, the young people build what I call in the book, the muscle memory of success. And by high school, it was like educational apartheid. It was, you know, there was sort of a advanced track that all the upper income kids or most of them were on. And there was a kind of basic track that most of the lower income kids were on. And the out of school experiences were continuing to mark that divide. So that, you know, I used to think that sort of ended when you got to college. And if you were one of those lower income kids and you got to college, then you kind of had it made. But what I've now realized is that for two kids who start the same college, and maybe they even both graduate 4 or 5 years later, the gaps get bigger, not smaller, because of all these sort of extracurricular summer learning, you know, sort of extended day in college learning experiences that are either there or not there.
Yeah. So that's a great segue. I mean, to the College for Social Innovation. I was really been very excited to learn about what you're doing there recently. A question that comes to me often is the work that we're doing here in a rural place, and some of our other micro college colleagues, people who have been on this podcast before, they're located in very remote wilderness places, and compared to folks in Alaska and Maine, we're kind of actually in town in a way. But people ask me, like, can you do this in the city, and can you do, like, what is this kind of scale and, like, you know, kind of holistic type of education look like in an urban place? And so, and the answer is, I think that you're part of the answer. So just describe for us what is the College for Social Innovation?
Yeah. So we run two programs. The name really comes out of my original vision, which was to create a full-fledged accredited four-year colleges where half the credits came from learning experiences, fellowships, internships, kind of work-based learning, where you would learn through, you know, rolling up your sleeves and working with mentors to accomplish important things. And that's an idea that's still sort of on the back shelf. But what we're doing now is running semester for impact and semester in the city. Semester in the city started almost 8 years ago. We've had more than 600 students complete the program. They all earn a full semester of academic credit. The cost to the student is the same or even a little less than they would pay going to whatever college they're going to. It's sort of sponsored by now 15 colleges. So much like study abroad, except instead of going abroad, which is can be a great experience also, they come to Boston, they get matched with a social impact internship at the Pine Street Inn, which is New England's largest homeless shelter, and does an amazing job placing families and individuals in stable housing after a period in the shelter, or one of a number of organizations working on climate change initiatives, urban farming initiatives. They might work on immigrant support. There's a huge number, particularly recently, of Haitian immigrants coming to Boston. And we've got a couple of nonprofits that particularly focus on that population, helping them get health benefits, helping them get settled. A lot of education organizations, public health organizations. And so these, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old students are leaving the kind of sage on the stage, traditional college environment, and they are moving to Boston for a semester. They're living with peers in some apartments we have, kind of learning some adulting skills, doing their own laundry, making their own food, which I think is maybe a similarity to what you're doing. But they have a mentor, they have a special project, And, you know, 4 days a week full time, they are rolling up their sleeves for 15 weeks to make a difference on an issue that they're passionate about and might also connect to what they're studying in school. So they're moving from kind of learning about problems in at a theory-based level, which is important to do, to working directly on solutions. And I think number one, just changing that cast of mind from a kind of problem-based mindset where it can feel pretty overwhelming and you can kind of give up, to a solutions-based mindset where you're recognizing it's not easy. There's no like easy answer, but you're feeling proud of moving forward with a team on some solutions. And you're in a community. And you know, Boston's a big city by some standards, a small city by other standards, but they're really identifying with, you know, the Alston Brighton Food Clinic or with a particular, you know, neighborhood in the Dudley section of Roxbury, maybe working with a nonprofit that is the first nonprofit in the country to get eminent domain authority over the abandoned housing in its neighborhood. And they're, you know, they're working to transform some of that abandoned housing into affordable housing. So it's been pretty amazing. I think it does have a lot of similarities to kind of this micro college movement, which I'm learning more about. It is life, you know, life-changing, I think, for the students. And two-thirds of them have been underrepresented students. So of the 600 students, right about two-thirds have been students of color, first-generation students, and/or Pell eligible students. And we want to continue that. Semester for Impact is a chance for students to stay on their college campus and do an in-depth internship in that community. We're University of New Hampshire and University of Vermont are our first two partners there. And both, or UNH in particular, is interested in some of the students being way up north in Coas County, which is as rural, I think, as where you are, and having students work in that community, which would be, you know, be an exciting development for us.
Yeah, there's a lot of amazing things there. I'd love to dig into. But maybe, I mean, starting with the theme of you know, the students that you're seeking to open up these opportunities for. I mean, underrepresented groups, you know, racial groups and economic groups, you know, even if there is scholarships or funds available, you know, there are cultural barriers to doing something like this. I think maybe from the family or from just the circle of people around them, and just, you know, what work have you done to open up this as a possibility, just conceptually, even for people who might not otherwise be able to do something like this?
That's so important, I think. I think a lot of it is building relationships with the mentors and club leaders on campus who underrepresented students trust. And it's when you get the person who's working with all the posse students or the students who've the students of color, and there's like a often like a gathering place and a few trusted mentors who are supporting them. And often they're in these very white communities. A lot of the colleges we work with are all of them, in fact, until one recent HBCU, are, you know, predominantly white institutions in very predominantly white communities. And so I think the key for us has been find, you know, a few students who, because of a trusted advisor, say that sounds like a really interesting thing to do, and to be in a more diverse community, making a difference. And then they, if they have a good experience, they then go back, and some of them become ambassadors for us. And so, like Colby College, which is up in Waterville, Maine, you know, a very white community, and the school is increasingly diverse, but still very much a white majority student body. The vast majority of the students from there who've come to Boston to do our program have been students of color. And they've been advised by other students of color, you should think about doing this. You're going to get some great networks, some great learning, and it's a chance to kind of diversify your college experience.
Yeah, that takes delicate and persistent work, is my impression. Yeah, and so yeah, that points to another, you know, seems really striking thing about your project. You have worked extensively to build this network with higher education institutions, with colleges and universities. throughout the Northeast, but even out in the Midwest, there's some schools that you've been working with, Erlin and Knox out in the Midwest. How have you done that, and what are those relationships like? What is the do your partners there, like, are they excited about what you're doing? Is it taking some time to convince them?
It's been, we've got 15 partners, and all of them have been slightly different stories about how it got going. Some have, from introduction to, a signed contract have been just 3 or 4 months, and some have been 3 or 4 years. I think the case we're making, and have, made successfully at least a few times over, is that this is really a win-win partnership. I think we're at a time where people are maybe a little more skeptical of higher education than they were 10 years ago. They, whether that's parents or students themselves, they're not 100% sure that just going and getting a degree is going to be the right path, with a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And so I think the idea of adding into the 4-year college experience, the chance to do one or multiple semesters that are different and that are really proven to build purpose, to build skills, to build networks, and are more likely to sort of help students along on the path from kind of college to career. And some colleges resist the idea of career. Like we're that's not our purpose. Our purpose is to build good thinkers and original thinkers. And I think that's great. And I like to position our work as we think so too. Like we think the best way to build the kind of problem solvers that our communities need, that democracy needs, is through these immersive experiences. It also will probably help you get a job, and people probably aren't going to go to college for much longer if they don't feel that helps them in pursue a career that's, pays them money. But it's not a careerist approach. It's about building a set of kind of skills and mindsets and approaches that allows you to make a difference in your own life, in your community, and wherever you work, whether that's a nonprofit, a government agency, a for-profit, or anywhere.
So this so first of all, the work that these interns that the students are doing, is this, can you characterize it in general? You mentioned some of the organizations they work with. Is this hands-on experience? Are they wielding a hammer or working in a soup kitchen, or are they working in offices, or what kind of things are they doing?
More typically working in offices, but also like doing outreach. They might be working in a, after school writing club, coaching high school kids on their college essays. They might be working at a public health center, helping to do intake interviews and providing some kind of coaching. They might be taking water samples along the Charles River and doing some analysis of, types of pollution. They might be helping to build urban gardens as part of an effort to, reduce food miles and increase the availability of like healthy food in sort of food deserts. The structure of the internships is about half the time is frontline work, including some of the examples I gave, and about half the time is a special project where the student has some autonomy. As one of our mentors says, you're CEO of your own special project, and you have a like a board, a board member who's your mentor who's kind of coaching you, but you've got some autonomy and some independence, and it's usually projects that are sort of important but not urgent. So if you know that like consultants have those quadrants, and there's a lot of things that are yes, they're important, but because they're not urgent, you haven't gotten to them yet. And it can be a perfect project for a motivated fellow or intern with
Totally.
just a little bit of guidance from, someone like you or me or one of our maybe younger colleagues. And that's a big part of what the students take out of this is they develop a new curriculum or they develop a new listing of, transitional housing options or an analysis of some evaluations that the nonprofit has done but never analyzed to learn from it. And that's a really meaty, deep project where I think a lot of the learning comes from that. And the students also take a class with us on Wednesday evening, and on Friday mornings. And those are positioned both to do what we call a small P and big P problem solving. So the small P problem solving is really help you succeed as an intern, and you know, later, you know, next year or the year after, as a sort of entry level employee and contributor. What are some skills you can build, and how do you kind of build your network and problem solve, and you know, get some advice from peers and staff around how to navigate through the challenges that anyone faces in a first job or an internship. And then the Wednesday evening class is a little more around big P problem solving, which is more like systemic level. So what are some case studies of communities that have made big progress on really sticky issues around affordable housing or education or the environment, et cetera? What are kind of pathways to progress and places where we're maybe making more progress as a society than you may know, and other places where we may feel more stuck?
Yeah, so these are the classes. They are experiences of no matter what the internship is, they're coming in. They're
correct.
These are things that can be applicable to whatever they're doing.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
We have a you know, PhD on staff who's our chief program officer, who taught history and sort of various social justice related courses at Wheaton College in Massachusetts for almost 30 years, and is now teaching that Wednesday class. And she and a couple other members of our staff lead on the Friday class. And it's, you know, the classes are also a powerful experience. And John Dewey said that learning is reflection upon experience. Mm-hmm. And as much as I believe in experiential learning, it's even more powerful when you have some organized reflection about the experience. And I think that's one of the things that the classes provides.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to phrase. I'll write that down. John Dewey has some quotable things. But I mean, yeah. I think that much of education is lacking in experience, right? It's all theory, right? It is reflection that's just on something that hasn't happened yet, your life, right?
Exactly. Or based on what a professor, you know, put into a book that maybe happened a long time ago.
There are experiential education experiences, which I think in practice are often quite reflective. But I think bringing it, you know, a theoretical academic, you know, a case study kind of approach to an experience you're having is can be really powerful in my experience.
I think so. I mean, I think most human beings learn the best from experiences and relationships. And yet we've designed school, both K-12 and college, to not have a lot of experiences and not really invest in the relationships as much as we could or should. And there's obviously exceptions to that. And there's service learning classes and there's wonderful, innovative, you know, high schools and colleges, I think some of which you've been associated with and I have been, that are kind of breaking the mold. But I think we need to make, we need to kind of not create a new mold, but create a new pathway that's really puts experience and relationships at the center, and makes that common. And also moves from a negative frame on a problem focused frame to a solutions frame. We include in our classes a fair amount of case studies from something called the Solutions Journalism Network. That is a group of journalists that have recognized that, you know, not only do most colleges focus on the negative and the problem, but most journalists and news outlets focus on the negative and the problem. And that's those two things together, colleges and our journalists, have kind of created a mindset for many people across society, many young people in particular, that, you know, the problems we face way outgun the solutions and our creative ability to solve them. And I think there's actually a lot of evidence that says, yeah, there's really big problems, but there's also incredibly creative solutions being worked on and making a difference. And, you know, in my lifetime, global extreme poverty has gone from 50% to 9%. Most people don't know that. They just focus on all the problems in the world. But there's, you know, the right to marry was not a reality when I was coming out of college. And now, for the most part, people can marry who they love. And so we need to, I think, zero in more on what are the solutions that are getting traction and what are solutions that are maybe getting traction in just a couple of places, but need to be applied more broadly and not lose hope because of the problems, which are real, but maybe not as unbeatable as we sometimes think.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think definitely despair, you know, cynicism is always a danger looking around modern humans and young people too. So it's great to tell some of those stories. Engage with doing something, I think it's really helpful. So I think a really interesting thing about what you do is it's not just the classes or the internships. You are also bringing people to live together, right, as you mentioned. And so that is something that certainly I hear people appreciating about our programs and seeking out in their educational experiences is some, you know, adulting or just some support, also living in community with small groups of people. So can you describe, first of all, how many participants are there in the cohorts of the semester in the city? And then, you know, what are the units and what is the structure they're living in? How do you support that?
Yeah. So look back over the last few years, and we've been averaging about 50 students a semester coming to Boston. And, you know, they occasionally, a couple of them, but maybe a couple will have a uncle or an aunt living in Boston that they'll live with. But the 95% come together, live in some apartments that are pretty near Boston University. They're on the MBTA, which is the public transportation in Boston. They're four bedroom apartments with one or two of the rooms dedicated to be doubles. So two people can live at a lower cost and you know, two or three of the rooms as singles. Usually anywhere from four to six students in an apartment. It's got a nice kitchen. It's got a couch and a couple of chairs, one and a half or two bathrooms. And the students are paying. We lease the apartments from landlords and then we pass them along at cost to students. We lose a little bit of money, but try to not lose too much money on the real estate side of what we do. And the students have an amazing experience. There's probably 50 places where you can get like a $8 or $9 lunch from from 25 different countries around the world. The South Korean barbecue and, you know, Mexican chili rellenos and everything in between within a 5-minute walk of the apartment. So you're experiencing that kind of urban ethnic mix. Plus you have a four burner stove and set up to cook. And so a lot of students who've never really cooked before, they've either had dining hall food at college or, you know, mom and dad's cooking at home, are now cooking, and they are learning through trial and error the way all of us learn. And, you know, one student might take Tuesday nights and another student might take Wednesday nights and maybe Thursday nights they go out together. And so that's great. And, you know, occasionally we have roommate issues and we got some staff who help us work through that and some community advisors who are kind of peer advisors. But overwhelmingly what we hear is like, I made some new best friends for life. I learned some skills. The first time I got on the T, which is what we call the public transportation, I got on the wrong way. And the next time there was someone who was, you know, giving me a hard time. But I kind of learned from that and laugh about that and grow because of those experiences and realize what a caring community there is around me. Like every student gives a little TED talk at the end of the semester. And some of the ones that are most memorable for me were people, a homeless person, a lady with fancy pearls on, other people that students just, they weren't like part of their internship or our program, they just met them out in the community and they ended up learning something powerful from them. And they ended up having a deeper experience of being in community than they'd maybe ever had before.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds really, that's wonderful. I think that the somewhere there's middle ground between totally independent on your own, you know, show up in the city with a bus and figure out how to live there. And then like the kind of very like entirely controlled campus experience that many people had, that there's a middle ground that I think is really,
I think so. We call this like semi-independent. And I do think there's a real issue in in the current generation of college age students. Number one, around COVID, that was a gut punch at a key developmental point, but also kind of helicopter parenting, not in all cases, but in some cases, that has limited young people's chance to kind of get out and gain some independence and some maturity from falling and picking yourself back up.
Yeah. So you are primarily, I know you have a few gap year students are starting to have more at people listening to this who are high school students. This might be something even to start your college journey. But primarily these have been students who are already in college somewhere else, and
Correct.
they come first semester and they go back to their home campus.
Right.
Have you what have you heard from those past participants? Are there some good stories about what they do afterwards, and how this has kind of changed their story?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of people who have a story like me. They came in a little aimless and they go back with a lot more force and purpose and kind of good ambition in a way, and some positive momentum. A student named Brady, I'm thinking of, came in by his own admission. He, I think hired a cousin or a sister to like write some of his papers. He, too often overslept, didn't make class, had, very mediocre grades, and came out of it, with like, that's crazy. Like I need to get my act together, and came out with a sense of purpose, and GPA went way up. I think sense of just like pride in his work went way up, and he's got a lot of momentum, I think, as he approaches the end of college. So we hear that a lot. Students go back, they become TAs, they sign up, many cases get hired for pay jobs by the places where they did a credited internship with us. One former student I'm thinking of really elevated her activism through her time with us, and a year later was proud to report that she got arrested sitting in Nancy Pelosi's office as part of the Sunrise Movement. So it,
Clubs.
sometimes it's good trouble. Yeah, sometimes it's very hands-on work they do. Sometimes it's more sort of system change work, but they're they're also finishing college at higher rates than their peers. So I think it's, they get a sense of motivation, and I think they're more hooked on learning than maybe they were before, and see a kind of pathway forward. They've got, and just the overwhelming thing is confidence. The students, yes, they build some skills, they build some networks, but really they build confidence that allows them to build more skills and more networks in the future.
Yeah, the higher rates of completion thing is no joke. That's an important factor, and there's a lot of emphasis on getting more people and underrepresented groups into college. But there also is there's some really troublesome statistics about rate of completion.
The data is really interesting. So we've almost closed the gap on income and race in terms of entering some kind of college. It's in some states it's closed, and it's close to closing compared to 30, 40 years ago, even 20 years ago. The college completion gap is still pretty significant. And then even where you have two students who complete college, they're kind of moving into a career track job, that's the biggest gap of all. And because of, I think, the unequal access to these kind of immersive internships and other kind of immersive experiences, that the data is very clear, predict success and ca cause success, because of the kind of learning that we're talking about. You mentioned gap years, and we so far the students have been pretty much an equal mix of like sophomores, juniors, and seniors in college. And that we think will remain our kind of core students doing this as like a semester away before kind of going back and completing college. It's part of, it's a fully credited semester that's part of the journey. But we, this last year, kind of by accident, had a couple students who said, "Hey, I'm not in college yet. I finished high school. Can I come for either fall or spring semester?" And two of them did it, and they were outstanding. They totally fit in the classes. They totally fit in the apartments, and they did a great job in their internships. And now they're, I think, they're entering college more ready to sort of excel and learn, and with more confidence than would have been the case otherwise. So we're this current coming fall and spring trying to grow that as a much more purposeful pilot and have up to 10 students each semester be gap year students. And so if you're out there listening to this and either you're between high school and college, or maybe you left college after a couple semesters and are wondering what's next and want to do a different kind of learning, let us know, and potentially a semester with us could be part of your journey.
Yeah, that's been a really important group for us, actually, are people who are not in college, maybe thinking about it, maybe have recently left without, you know, not completing, and just looking for a different path. And there, it's great to know of some of these things that are also, especially, it's important that they are semi-independent or independent in a way, because people who've lived on their own for a while are also, you know, they're not ready to go back into a really, like, you know, babying kind of environment as some of these places are.
Exactly. They want to be more independent. They're hungry for leadership, but a little bit of scaffolding to help them lead is helpful.
Yeah. So you work with colleges and universities, you work with the students and I assume their families. You're also working with the hosts of these internships.
Right? Yes.
So these are nonprofits, they're and other kind of organizations. How do you work with them? How do you support the students in their interactions with their hosts? And what is that like?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a big part of our secret sauce, but it's not secret. It's just maybe special sauce. Is the a couple of elements to this. Number one, the matching process. So all students, you know, apply to be in our program, and we open the doors. Most students who apply, you know, get in, but through that process, we learn what their passions are, what they're interested in, maybe what their major would require some internship to be connected to. So that's one process. And then at the same time, we'll have, you know, maybe 100 different potential host organizations apply and say, we've got this project we've been wanting to do for a couple of years to kind of, you know, work with this data, or to develop a new alumni community, or to, you know, build a new curriculum for high school students doing XYZ. So we then look through this, essentially the two applications, and propose a match. Both parties, the mentor and the student, have a chance to meet. They can each veto the match, but 95% of the time we move forward with that match because we put some thought into it. So the matching process is one key. Second, I mentioned mentor. That's usually when folks have an internship, they just get an internship with some organization. And about 4 days before they show up, the executive director of that organization says, hey, Jacob, will you mentor so-and-so? And it's sort of thrown together at the last minute.
Yeah,
I know, because I used to do this myself in previous nonprofits. And what we do is we say, actually, part of your application has to be not only what's the project going to be, but who's the mentor and why do they want to be a mentor? Mm-hmm. Because not everyone wants to be a mentor. But we have a pre-qualified group of people who are like, I love mentoring young people. I like managing people sort of coming into their careers. It's fun for me. It's a way for me to contribute. So that's, I think, a second part of the special sauce. And the third part is the special project, that it's not going to be just making copies and getting coffee and doing whatever comes up right that day. There might be some days where you do some of that, but, you know, again, about half your time is going to be something that you're CEO of the project. And that's going to be developed thoughtfully. So all those systems up front, we train the mentors, they go through a training, and then we have kind of weekly communication with the students and the mentors. Mostly pretty light touch, just a quick, you know, two question survey, like, how are things going? A more in-depth mid-semester meeting. But if needed, you know, the student might have to be on a performance improvement plan, or, you know, if needed, we'll step up our support and have a staff to do that. Or the mentor might need to be on a performance improvement plan, but we're there to be kind of an advocate and a problem solver as needed with each individual match.
Yeah. So this, you know, you're tapping into, you know, these are really deep old forms of education, right? Apprenticeship, mentorship, this kind of journeyman kind of relationship that goes back before schools, long, long ago,
Yes.
skilled things. And those were always held. I've become increasingly fascinated with that history. These are embedded deeply into the most profound parts of culture within religious organizations or
Yes.
with like these guilds, which have all kinds of like
Yes.
cultural things with them. And so I think that's being held within a cultural organization like a college, it really makes a lot of sense for this to happen. You're really birthing a person into adulthood in a way in the
Absolutely.
world of work.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to this idea that most learning is through experiences and relationships. So my previous organization was all about apprenticeships for middle school students, but this is really an apprenticeship for a college student. And there's actually a lot of research on what some people in the literature call cognitive apprenticeships. Because if you think of apprenticeships, you think of a, Ben Franklin and the printing press, and it feels very blue collar, and that's awesome. Those can be great apprenticeships too. But doctors have apprenticeships. They call them fellowships, right? Lawyers go clerk for a judge. That's kind of like an apprenticeship. And in any field, marketing, public health, et cetera, apprenticeships make sense. And there's actually a whole educational theory around that informs apprenticeship learning, where there's a four-stage process of the sort of teacher modeling, and then scaffolding, and then coaching, and then fading. And so in that last, the modeling is, someone who's an amazing silversmith or an amazing public health professional is like bringing you in to let me watch me do my thing. But then there's like some scaffolding. Here's some guidance as to how you over the next 7 weeks might approach this project. Here's some tools, just like a painter uses scaffolding to get to the second floor. Coaching, this worked well. This could, thanks for that draft. Here's where you can make it a little better. And then fading, kind of get the hell out of the way as the apprentice does more and more of the work.
Yeah, that's so powerful. I think it's someone we've had on the podcast before, really inspiring thinker is Zach Stein, who talks the description of his vision for education. His book is Education in a Time Between Worlds, and the vision for the education of the near future that he lays out is a lot like what you're doing, actually. It's first within the community. Everyone really has an opportunity to be a teacher in one way or another about what they
Yes.
work. And it has this important quality of, true education for free human beings, for adults who are going to stand on their own, has to be the teacher's goal is to work themselves out of a job. They have to be surpassed even
Yes.
by the people in the, within a particular timeline. Otherwise, it's not working.
Yes. You want to inspire these problem solvers who can solve the problems that you're still wrestling with. And we talk about that within our organization is let's not, we should probably stop using the term student because it tends to be even a little demeaning and kind of create this hierarchy. And they maybe apprentice is a better one. Like we should think of the students, the people who are enrolled in colleges or the gap year students as people who are, they might be a little younger, they might be a little earlier in their kind of social change journey, but they're going to have some really good insights, and we need to create like an intergenerational kind of coalition of people trying to make things better. And there's places where I or someone on our staff is going to have a lot of good guidance, or one of the mentors will, but there's places where the young people are going to really have some essential insights.
Yeah, the old language of the guilds is the apprentice, the journeyman, and the master, right? And
Right, right.
there's a progression there that's meaningful. The goal is to not always be an
Totally.
apprentice.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So financially, these are students who are generally in college, and so their funding for these programs is how does it generally work?
Yeah, the basic model is that the student keeps on paying sort of whatever they've been paying to the college, which if they're on full scholarship, it's nothing. If they're at, Colby College, it's 80, and they're not on scholarship at all, it's 82,000 a year. Right. So they're paying something or maybe not that much. But that financial aid kind of follows them. They usually save a little bit because on the room and board, they're probably going to pay less. They'll most colleges have it set up that for tuition, student keeps paying their regular amount, whether that's a little or a lot, and the college pays us a fee. And for room and board, the college just pays us, or the student pays us instead of the college. And that usually costs a little bit less. So they can save a little there. We're part of the AmeriCorps program. So students earn about a $2,000 scholarship through being in the program, which is great. We provide a small stipend and a little food reimbursement to ease the cost of living in Boston. But if they, you know, most sort of board costs are a couple thousand dollars for like the meal plan at a college for a semester. And if you, you know, put $1,000 of that in the bank and $1,000 you used for some extra spending money in Boston, you'd be in great shape. That plus the money that we provide. So that's the basic financial model. Colleges are paying us, they're paying us less than any study abroad program I know of, a little less than some other peer organizations that operate semester programs, you know, but not nothing. And that is something that we're working with colleges and like, how do we make this a not just a pedagogical win-win for you and your students and us, but a financial win-win, where hopefully by partnering with us, that allows you to maybe attract a few more students, sure, retain a few more students, and that provides some financial benefit to the college, again, as well as sort of educational benefit to the students.
And then the internship hosts, is there an exchange of money there?
It's a very small amount, but yes, they depending on our model, they're paying sort of in the 500 to 800 range per semester, you know, for someone who's going to be with them for about 400 hours. So it's a modest fee. Actually, in the initial design, we had no fee. It was going to be free. And I remember a day 8 years ago, I met with three different potential partners. They said, this is great. We're definitely going to apply to have a student, but you really should charge us something just so we have like some skin in the game. And I said, all right, you know, first person who said it, I was a little skeptical, but then when three straight people said it, sorry, you don't have to ask anymore. So it's not a big part of our revenue base, but I do think it builds some skin in the game for them. The main thing they're giving is mentorship, interesting work. And so that, and the benefit, it's the whole program is designed for the primary benefit of the student.
And that goes to show, I mean, it could well be the other way. I mean, I think we've talked, I mean, farms in particular, you know, who we've approached about possibly doing internships, and some have done it for free and some have paid, you know, interns. But often enough, it's like, wow, to take on an intern is actually a whole other job for us. And, you know, even if we are getting some benefit from the labor, it is a, you know, something we'd like to do, but to do it, we'd need some.
You need to pay up.
Yeah, exactly. So what you're saying, it sounds like your partners are, you know, are finding it of benefit enough that they're willing to even a little bit pay it.
I think so. Yeah. And so that's sort of on us. We need to show this experience is compelling enough for not just the student. We have a lot of data on that. And if it's not compelling, they're not going to recommend, you know, that their peers come back, but it needs to be compelling for the host organization. And it needs to, this goes back to like a classic debate in like the Peace Corps. Is it mostly about the people who do the service, or is it mostly about the communities where they serve and the impact? And in my view, you need to really start centering it on the impact, because when you have impact in the community or for one of these nonprofits, you then learn more, and you get more nonprofits, more communities that say, yeah, we're willing to provide the mentorship because we see it makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, also what you were saying about the mentors, this is interesting work, right? If people, in my experience also, we have many, many different people who teach, you know, a day, they're a guest speaker, or they do a workshop, or they, you know, they allow us to do something on their farm. And this is true with high school students here as well. It's many people, maybe I would say a majority of people, enjoy teaching a little bit.
Yes.
They know about what they're excited about. And it is, I think, enriching to their lives.
100%. For a lot of our mentors are sort of relatively young, but, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years into their career, staff for whom this is a way to kind of practice going to the next level in a more of a management role. And it's a way to give back. It's another sort of learning theory is that you learn the most when you're actually teaching others.
Yeah.
You know, if you can discuss it with others, that you learn pretty much more than if you just like listen to it. But if you can actually teach it back to someone else, then you really, really learn it. And so I think that's a lot of our mentors experience that. Like they, I understand my job better because I was teaching it to a CFSI intern.
Yeah. And then it also ties into those important but not urgent projects, right? Those, you know, as a person running organizations, those are always there. They're sitting there. Like if we had
100%.
Somebody who had the time to do it, that'd be huge. And I think also just even talking with a person, an intern or a student who's working on that is often really stimulating, moving something ahead that can have a very transformative experience.
And a lot of times someone coming in from the outside, I mean, is going to have new, maybe naive questions, but often naive questions that lead to better answers. And maybe some interesting perspectives. And so just, you know, just like the research on diversity, like diverse perspectives can lead to better outcomes. Having maybe a couple of interns over the course of the year coming from different experiences mixed up with your team in different ways might lead your team to come up with some more innovative answers to the challenges that you're working on.
Yeah. Amazing. So also people out there who run an organization or a business, this is, I think, something to think about. This is a benefit for creating some sort of a supported, mentored program like this, or finding one, supporting one in your community, wherever you are.
And what you're trying to do, I think what we're trying to do is be at the middle of a triangle of like colleges, students, and host organizations or community organizations, and pulling the best out of all of them. It's like students bring this incredible energy and idealism and fresh approaches. Colleges can provide credit, and they're like a big institution, $700 billion institution in American life. And then host organizations have all this pent up capacity that, you know, to provide some mentoring. And we're basically deputizing a set of really, really great mentors to be kind of adjunct professors with a classroom size of one. And it's a powerful learning model.
Yeah, cool. So you are, you know, the College for Social Innovation. And I know you said early on there was a beginning, this was a vision for a four-year college. And it is striking that you're using that word college in the way that we are, which is you know, there's something in that word that's still worthwhile somehow.
I'm
curious
so
to know what you think about that. But, you know, as do you have a picture of where you would like this to go? Because it does seem like you it's experimental, it's growing. Where you know, do you have a sense of how this looks a few years down the road?
So we want to grow just a little bigger, from, you know, 40, 50 students a semester up to maybe 75 a semester in Boston. We think that could still be a great learning community size. And we have plenty of placements, and we could get, you know, a few more apartments to accommodate the students. We think that would just give us a stronger platform and data to sort of share out with our college partners. We want to grow this semester for impact to, you know, we'll have four colleges participating this coming fall, you know, grow that to six or eight or more colleges. I think that's a more scalable model, where we don't need the apartments and some of the other things that we need for a semester in the city. And then we're looking at a couple ideas. One idea is to develop a master's degree program that would be open to anyone, but might be particularly great for some of our alumni. That would be it would be very immersive. So half or more of the credits to get a master's degree in nonprofit management and social innovation would come from some special projects and some sort of immersive stretch projects. And then there'd be maybe, instead of full-time class for a few semesters, there'd be maybe 5 or 6 weeks of like 1 week sort of immersive courses. And this would be put together in a very low cost, high impact master's degree. So that's one idea we've toyed with. We're also open to the idea of developing like a true micro college that was 2 or 4 year certified, where a handful of students could really experiment with or work with us to sort of demonstrate the value of an immersive college experience that got you 128 credits, got you hopefully more learning than than a lot of students are getting today through this approach of, you know, there wouldn't be no classes, but maybe it'd be half kind of work-based, internship-based learning with special projects, reflection papers, et cetera, and half other classes that either we or partner colleges would teach. So that's haven't sort of given up on that dream. Right now, I think really our ultimate goal is to move the field, change the vector a little bit within the field of higher education. And if we find that through Semester in the City and Semester for Impact, we can get more colleges, you know, taking experiential learning more seriously and having it not be a couple evenings at the food bank, but really more immersive, not be just extracurricular, but curricular, that's awesome. We can get the current system to kind of move in that direction. Fantastic. And until we do, we're just going to keep developing some kind of pilots and experiments that hopefully we can learn from, and we can kind of share the learning with others.
Yeah, it seems to be eminently scalable or replicable. You know, different cities, different situations. So it seems it's a powerful idea. Just the Semester for Impact is now four colleges are from University of Vermont, University of New Hampshire. Where else?
UMass Dartmouth, which is part of the UMass system, and Delaware State University, which is an HBCU in Delaware, with those latter two starting this coming fall with the first cohorts, and looking to grow that to, you know, probably four campuses fall and spring, and then maybe five or six the year after. So that's a really great opportunity for colleges to, you know, help make a deeper difference right in their home community. And, you know, some students love the idea of coming to a new community like Boston, and some, like, they're really happy. They don't want to leave campus. And so the chance to do this kind of immersive experiential learning in their home campus community is compelling.
Fantastic. Well, that's the kind of top of our hour there. Eric, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us on the podcast, and thank you for the work you're doing. It's very, very interesting. I'm very excited to know about it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jacob. Yeah, College for Social Innovation. And I really appreciate you inviting us, and I'm really excited to be sort of a urban cousin of the work that you're doing at Thoreau College and other micro colleges are doing around the country.
Thank you.